I'm Jonathan Freeman, and I'm on Cinepod.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben Rock.
Hey there, Ilya Friedman.
How are you doing?
I'm doing swell here in the heat-domed world that we live in, where it's super hot. Actually, it hasn't been that hot in L.A. We got the June gloom. For those of you who aren't familiar with L.A., every summer, when you get into May and June, they call it the May gray and the June gloom. You got the hot summer air coming in from the desert, hitting the freezing cold Pacific Ocean, and you basically just get an overcast day.
Sort of a marine layer, if you would.
That is precisely what it is. And it keeps everything like, you know, this morning it was like in the upper 60s. So our summer doesn't really get miserable until usually July-ish when that stops happening, when the Pacific Ocean warms up enough that that's not happening anymore. So right now we're in that mode.
Yeah, there are four seasons in LA, but three of them are summer and one of them is fire. That's pretty much how it works.
I'll take it over everywhere else.
I don't blame you. And a lot of people feel exactly the same way. So, Ben, who is our guest on the show today?
Jonathan Freeman, an interview you conducted about The Three-Body Problem, a big hit series on Netflix.
Absolutely. And it was a great conversation. We'll get into that conversation in just a few minutes. But first, Ben, a lot of things going on right now. Where do you want to start for our
close focus?
Well, I think we should start with us.
All right, let's start with us. We just hit a huge milestone. We surpassed 2 million downloads of our podcast, which is just mind-blowing. We've been doing it for so long, and here we are. Now, I got to say, 2 million happened a lot faster than 1 million. So
it's 1 true. Million 1 million was like a year or two ago after doing it for like, at that point, it was like 8 years, 9 years. And then in 1 year, we double it.
Pretty much, yeah. Okay, so Ben, what else should we talk about in our close focus here? There's other stuff going on. It was a big weekend at the box office.
Oh, well, it was a super noteworthy week at the box office. And, you know, I've been a little depressed about, because I love the movie-going experience. I don't want to think that movies are going away and people aren't going to go see movies in theaters. To me, there was always something special about going to see a movie in a theater. If it came out in theaters, that was your opportunity to see something as well as it could be exhibited. And the fact that Furiosa and The Fall Guy and If, like all these movies one after another this summer, were just underperforming or outright bombing. And, you know, I'm especially upset about Furiosa because I love that movie. And so it's been honestly very heartening to see that last week, Bad Boys 4, and then this week, Inside Out 2. Now, granted, these are both ongoing IP things, although so is Furiosa, and basically breaking box office records. Like, I was like, are we going to have our Barbenheimer summer this year or not? And I was thinking, it didn't feel very likely that we were going to get a good old Barbenheimer of our own this time around. And lo and behold, Inside Out 2 came to the rescue. Now, you know, part of it is that Inside Out has been sitting on Disney Plus since Disney Plus first dropped, whatever, you know, 6 years ago. And lots of kids have grown up watching Inside Out over and over and over. And I know one of those kids. And those
that
kids
kid is asleep in your house right now.
Yeah. So Inside Out 2 is like one of those movies that's good for the first Inside Out, rather, is good for parents and kids. The second one, which I didn't see, but my son and wife did go see. Like, I've heard nothing but raves about it. It sounds like
it's
just a beautiful, yeah, wonderful film, and one that kind of does what Pixar does at its best. Interestingly, I heard a story, I think it was from Matt Bellamy on The Town, where they were talking about the returning stars, because two very noteworthy stars of Inside Out did not return, and those were Bill Hader and Mindy Kaling. Both of them became much bigger stars since the first one. And supposedly, outside of Amy Poehler, none of the actors got paid super handsomely. On The Town, they said that Amy Poehler was paid like $5 million and that each other actor was paid like $100,000. Now, I sort of feel like for Bill Hader doesn't need to do this. Probably he's got a lot going on in his life, and probably, you know, same with Mindy Kaling. But you do kind of think like $100,000 is $100,000, man. Like, you know, you're not really talking about that much work.
But they probably would have been able to wear their pajamas and do it from home too, even. It's
I wouldn't be surprised if all these people have professional level, if you and I can have pretty decent audio recording in our house, someone who's at Bill Hader or Mindy Kaling level probably has access in their house to top level stuff. But anyway, it's heartening for me to see that when properly incentivized, people will go to the theater. And oh boy, did they. What was the full weekend gross for Inside Out 2?
$154 million, which is basically matching or surpassing what the Planet of the Apes movie, the most recent one, did in 6 weeks. So yeah. That was phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's intense. And I'm just glad. I'm relieved. But here's ready for my ham-fisted segue.
Uh-huh.
In movie theater news, the Alamo Drafthouse was purchased by Sony Pictures.
Yeah, that's a real interesting one because it kind of goes back to like the Paramount rulings where movie theaters are not supposed to be owned by movie studios.
It's an antitrust. It's an antitrust violation. And so, you know, I was looking into it a little bit. So for people who don't know what we're talking about, it was in, I believe, the 40s. Congress passed a law that basically said that the same company could not produce the movie and exhibit the movie and distribute the movie. Like basically they're making money off the movie three times.
Yeah.
And what it would force is like lesser movies would be, theaters would be forced to show them because they were owned by Paramount or whatever. Like you said, it's a Paramount ruling. That's what it's affectionately called. And it was vertical integration. I actually keep hearing lately people saying something is vertically integrated, like that's a good thing. And I'm like, doesn't that just mean you have a monopoly on your thing? But whatever. So apparently in the 80s, Ronald Reagan disassembled some of these rulings, like his Justice Department kind of took away some of it. And then surprising to no one, in the last 8 years, Donald Trump got rid of the last of it. And so there were suspicions creeping about that some distributor was going to buy a movie theater chain. You could imagine, theoretically, say, for instance, Universal Studios buying AMC theaters or buying Regal theaters. The only exception to this that I ever knew of, but this is like a one-off and it's also an LA specific thing.
Yeah, Disney with...
Yeah, yeah, the El Capitan Theater, which is on Hollywood Boulevard, is owned by Disney and pretty much exclusively shows Disney movies.
Yeah, and that's kind of the thing. The idea was that if you were a studio and you controlled the theaters and you controlled the distribution and the manufacturing, you would control what everyone saw. And so the idea was to prevent that from happening, to prevent smaller movie studios from being completely shut out who couldn't afford to then also buy the real estate and distribute. So it's interesting that Sony sees life in Alamo Drafthouse in particular, which filed for bankruptcy for one or two of their locations not that long ago. And
Alamo Drafthouse itself filed for bankruptcy and they went into, I think, Chapter 7,
yeah.
Reorganization like 2 or 3 years ago. Now, Alamo Drafthouse, I want to say, was started by Tim League, who's a freaking genius. And he also has a video imprint and they put out like really interesting stuff, usually like classic weird stuff like Miami Connection or Roar or stuff like that. And Tim League also runs, in my opinion, my favorite film festival I've ever attended, Fantastic Fest.
It's famous.
Austin, Texas. He's brilliant. And Alamo Drafthouse theaters are boutique kind of a theater experience. So there's only 35 of them in the whole country. I don't know if that's 35 after the ones in outside of Austin in Texas shut down. But I love Alamo Drafthouse. They have great food. They have amazing sound and picture quality. The seats are about as comfortable as anything. And I used to work at an art house theater. I was a projectionist and manager at an art house theater in Orlando called the Enzian Theater, which is still running. And if you're in Orlando, go there. We did full food service. But when I went to the Alamo Drafthouse for Fantastic Fest, I was like, oh my God, have they got the food service down to a science?
Yeah, they figured it out. Yeah,
your viewing experience is never interrupted by a waiter coming by and asking for your card. Now, the Enzian doesn't do that either. But back in the day when I worked there, literally, you know, you'd be in the third act of the movie and a waiter would come and drop a check and you'd have to pay for it, which they were very efficient at doing. But the Alamo Drafthouse is crazy efficient at doing it. So anyway, they sold to Sony and Alamo Drafthouse, I believe, controls it is under 5%. It might be under 2% of the movie theaters in the country. It's only 35 movie theaters. So the real question is, what does a major studio like Sony want with a very niche specialty distributor?
I can't imagine that it's to not grow it. I can't imagine that it's to, you know, leave it alone. But the early sort of buzz about is they want to do event style anime through their Crunchyroll property.
Yeah.
I've heard that they want to bring in hardcore fans for the big screen experience for watching anime. Sounds awesome. I totally went to see Akira on the big screen. I'd totally go watch, you know.
So random. I was just watching Akira last night that you're mentioning it.
I watched Akira 3 days ago. That's incredible.
Is it on the big screen?
Well, no, I watched it in my living room 3 days ago. But no, it's like.
I was a fan of the original comic or the original manga. And then when it came out as a movie, I went and saw it. And I don't think I've ever seen a single movie that was so perfectly adapted from its source material. Like, it looked the same. It looked like the comic book had just been frame grabs from the movie. For all I know, that's how they did it.
It's a weird movie. It's not. It's not without its charm, but it's a weird movie. If you've never seen Akira,
weird.
Yeah, buckle up. You're in for some weird.
Such a good movie. Anyway,
all right. So Ben, you know, interesting. Not to throw more gasoline on the whole Alamo Drafthouse Sony thing, but I've been being fed social media posts about them trying to unionize as well. So Alamo Drafthouse employees have been trying to also form a union, and that was going on right here as the Sony acquisition. So there's a bunch of moving parts here. You know, the story is certainly not over. We're going to be following it with interest in the coming weeks. But for all those who say that the movie going experience is dead, I don't see Sony buying something that they think is dead.
Stories of the death of the theatrical experience are exaggerated. I mean, I do think that everyone was expecting one major theater chain to go out of business this summer. I think that also might have, the pause button might have been hit on that by the runaway success of Inside Out 2, which will have a halo effect. Those people will return and see other movies. People will return to see that movie again. It's going to raise all boats, as they say, I hope. God, I hope. I want people to keep going to movie theaters. Jesus Christ. What do I got to do, people?
Clearly, we just need more properties like Inside Out 2, and people will keep going to the theater.
Well, so. Luckily for you, we've got a movie called Deadpool and Wolverine coming out, and that'll definitely scratch that IP itch, but it looks to be turning Marvel's bad luck around as well. So let's keep our fingers crossed.
All right. Hey, let's get to the interview with Jonathan Freeman.
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
I'm joined now by Jonathan Freeman, one of the cinematographers for the new hit Netflix series, Three Body Problem. Jonathan, welcome to the Cinematography Podcast.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you having me on.
We're really glad to have you. You know, I really enjoyed the series, particularly the early episodes of Three Body Problem, which I know that you shot, which I'm really excited that we get to talk about this. You know, I was talking to another DP recently, Chris Komen, ASC. He's been around a long time. He was telling me that one of the hardest things he feels like to do as a DP, and the thing that it really separates, you know, just sort of like run-of-the-mill television series or movies, is how they deal with exposition, how they're able to get the exposition out of the way to draw people into the story and to be able to move things along. The first episode of Three Body Problem is so masterfully put together, and the way that the shots feed into each other, and you're telling these different stories. Can you talk at all about dealing with exposition in particular? Is there something about exposition? Like, do you fear an early episode or a beginning of a story, or is it a unique challenge? Or tell me about exposition in cinematography.
Well, it's a great question. In particular for this project, not just for, you know, the beginning episodes, but for the entire series, it was a great challenge that was put in front of David, Dan, and Alex, who are the showrunners, to take material which is based on a Chinese science fiction writer. And the reason why it's so popular, I believe, is twofold. Of course, it is dramatic, which makes that's a lot easier to translate. But what makes it quite exciting to read, I think, for a lot of science fiction fans is the complexity of the scientific theory put into practice almost. And that itself is, in order to kind of explain that, we would rely on exposition. And, you know, you usually need a character to kind of explain it, but you can't explain it in too much of a complex way because you want your audience to kind of not get bored, A, and also be able to understand it. So in general, I'd say exposition can be a big challenge for cinematography, because basically it's usually visually somebody explaining something to the audience, which is not very exciting or interesting usually. But in our case, a lot of what would need to be explained can be visually dramatized through imagery in our show, particularly with VFX. So I think in that sense, we had a challenge to kind of figure out how we would do it, but ultimately a much more satisfying result usually.
Yeah, I think it's so well done. I watched the first episode twice, and I got to say that Three Body Problem in particular is a show that wants you to pay attention to it. It's not spoon feeding you information. It's letting the information sort of fold out or unfold quite often visually and sequentially and in the way that it's all sort of chopped up and put together, because you have, certainly in episode one, multiple storylines which seem to be happening disparate from each other. It starts off in 1960s China, and then also simultaneously in 2024 London, or in the UK. So you've got these two sort of different worlds, and only, I want to say probably about, you know, maybe 4/5 of the way through the episode, do you understand that there's a connection between one story and the other. And it's done so beautifully with this little, I want to say either a pan or a little dolly move to reveal a photograph on the shelf, so that for the first time you understand that this person is in China, has a relation in the world of London, which it's just, to me, it's this little visual cue. And if you're not paying attention to that, if you're a two screen person, if you're on your phone while you're watching the show, it's not going to work for you. This show requires you to be fully engaged, but it's just such little moments like that, which I loved, and how this story starts to come together. Can you talk at all about that moment in particular and how that importance, or it was, how much importance was that in your conversations leading up to that reveal?
Basically, that linking shot is in the page, actually. It's written very, very specifically that we end up on a close-up. And so a lot of times when things are on the page, there's a lot of ways it can be done. One thing I would say that's great about Dan and David is that, you know, I worked with them many years on Game of Thrones, and they are very adverse to trickery. Anything that feels like it's very showy or gets in the way of the storytelling. And, you know, if we were going to do a crane shot, there had to be some kind of motivation for it in the story, not in just to be a cool shot. Cool shots never made the cut. So, you know, learning through that, we certainly embrace that idea that, you know, less is more. And that's always been our philosophy.
Yeah, I think it's a great philosophy. And absolutely, yeah. As an audience member, I know I always appreciate that. And not just because it's like, it's a little bit of a trick here. Oh, we were able to choreograph this. But there's something that when your point of view, as you describe, shifts so naturally from one thing to another, it's as if you're so involved in the story. It's like, it's not a hard cut. It's like, there's so many ways that you guys could have ended on that shot that would have not have had the same effect. Like, you could have easily just done a cutaway. You could have done like a close up. Yes. You could have done all these different things, and none of them would have been as effective as just that little move and the rack focus, which then it was like, and of course the very next scene is in China, is at the satellite dish. And so it then of course draws the audience even for it. Like, so if you weren't paying attention, if you missed this, now we're going to remind you right now with this cut, and now the story is complete. There's so much going on in Three Body Problem, and in this episode in particular, you've got a couple of big looks and set pieces. I've already mentioned you've got 1960s China, you've got 2024 London. You also have sort of this video game virtual world sort of thing too. So I feel like there's sort of like three big looks. Each one of them is distinct and different. Definitely, I felt that 1960s China has a bit of a, and it could all just be in the grade, but it definitely felt to me like it had a little bit more of a stylized, maybe more sort of like classic look. 2024 London felt very modern and clean and cinema and real. It felt like any sort of a big budget production. And then the virtual video game world has this ethereal quality of like, it's realistic, but it's not real. And there's something sort of artificial about it and stylized. Can you talk at all about what you did visually to separate these three worlds and give each one of them sort of a distinct look?
Yes. Yeah, so the first big question that we had to ask in relation not just to these three set pieces for the first episode, but ultimately for the series, the first question I asked Dan, David, and Alex was the aspect ratio. And scale was obviously something we wanted to express. Widescreen was always great conduit for that. So we chose 2:3:5, which was pretty classic widescreen format. And this would lead well into a lot of our environments that we were presenting for the first season, but of course would be advantageous for any future seasons. Since this is ultimately going to be a space story, widescreen really helps sell the vastness of space and the distance and scale. But it also allowed us opportunities where you're using a wider screen format on a close-up of a character is equally, you know, the close-up would become like a landscape in itself. So it was important to make sure that when we were building these different worlds that we found, you know, the right aspect ratio that would service all the storylines. You know, once we kind of settled in on that, and we were very grateful that Netflix was willing to stream that, because not all streamers are comfortable with such a wide format. And then secondly, the lenses were also important, the glass that we would use to tell our story. Particularly, some of these older lenses have these beautiful sort of oval-shaped bokeh. So basically, when I was talking to different companies, and when I approached Arri had suggested I check out these new prototypes that were being developed by Greg Fraser and Arri on the Batman. You know, they had exactly all that beautiful bokeh that you would expect, but the center was optically pure.
Is this the alpha lenses?
These are the what will become the production alphas, yes.
All right, great.
So, yeah. But, you know, they also had these chromatic aberrations to them, sort of like these distorted, stretchy little bits in the edges of the frame just look funky.
Yeah, yeah.
And kind of otherworldly. And so these were lenses that are very unique, never seen before, except on the Batman. And, you know, I just like the idea that it had something that in some ways it could be interpreted as sort of an alien's point of view. It's not quite, you know, or something. I don't know. I just liked the fact that it had all these beautiful aspects to it, but it also had a uniqueness to it.
I assume then this is a large format show. Is this Alexa Mini LF or something?
Alexa LF primarily.
Yeah, that's great. All right, so I got one more real topic I kind of want to talk about three-body problem, and that is the video game virtual world, virtual. When I saw that, my first thought was virtual stage, but there's something about it that just doesn't really feel exactly like virtual stage to me, and I can't exactly put my finger on it. You have all these dramatic sort of like lighting effects and stuff going on too, because, you know, if you haven't watched Three Body Problem and you haven't watched episode one, nothing we've said in this episode is really going to give it away, but there are these very dramatic lighting, sun, day, night, weather sort of effects that go on inside this virtual world. I'm not asking you to entirely pull back the curtain, but can you give us a little bit more of an understanding of how you did that, how that video game world existed? What did you guys do lighting-wise to make it happen?
Yes, so well, the virtual world was certainly one of the biggest challenges I ever had faced as a cinematographer. You know, we had to figure out a way to make the lighting feel real. Basically, we were shooting on a stage. It was about 110 feet long by about 45, 50 feet wide. It was a very large space. And the idea was to create an array of light as a light wraparound. So if you can imagine like a hockey rink cut in half, but longitudinally. And basically, we would create an array of sky panels, sky panels being like almost like a pixel, but a very large pixel. And the ray would stretch around to, I think it was like 70 rows of sky panels that would wrap around that were 14 rows high, almost 1,300 sky panels ultimately. Wow. And then we put a Roscoe scrim in front of it to soften the light, obviously.
Sure.
And there we would be able to
blend those pixels a bit. Yeah, yeah, I get it.
And so we would create, you know, obviously not only could we create like time, like a sky patterns, like a sunrise or a sunset or a dusk or a dawn, but also we could integrate movement and transitions into that.
Sure.
And then on top of that, we, of course, would have to add supplemental lighting for the harder light to come in.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was a very complex system, but overall, the intent was just to create a lower res volume that we could have still recreate these light environments the way you might be able to do in a regular volume.
All right. So I'm envisioning what it is that you've got going on here, and it sounds like a monumental task. I got to ask a couple more questions to make sure that I'm understanding it correctly. Mm-hmm. You've got like 1,300 sky panels built essentially in an arcing wall around like a hockey rink. I'm wondering how high is the top sky panel from the floor level? And also, is there like a level of green screen before the sky panels start? Because I imagine most of this is for the sky and lighting effects and things like that. I mean, I'm assuming that's mostly for light and not for like a virtual background. Aren't mapping a background onto there. So there's a VFX element in this somewhere because you've got these incredible vistas. How tall is that? And is there a green screen element somewhere in there?
Yeah, that's a great question. The height, probably about 20 feet high. But the key thing was ultimately the world that these characters would be in would be completely replaced by VFX. Mm. But the challenge was that they had to feel like they were interacted, that they were interacting with the light that's surrounding them. So you would see that light affecting them. So that's why I kind of did this initial test, because on the test, what I effectively did is put a green screen, generated a green screen just around the character based on the angle of the camera. And so they would get a clean roto line from that, but they would still have the advantage of having all that other light wrapping around the character that would feel much more realistic to the environment.
Well, it's a very effective sequence, especially the first, I think the first time we're really in that world where we see how hot the sun really is, and you've got these characters who are hiding behind this rock for, you know, what tiny bits of shade that they can possibly get. And you can just, it's palpable to feel like the effect of the heat and seeing the motion of the sun and the shrinking of the shadow. It really works well. I want to switch gears a little bit now. Let's talk about the early days of Jonathan Freeman. Let's talk about how you decided to get into this crazy business. When did you get the bug? When did you decide that this was something that you could do?
Well, it happened very early for me. I was a youngster, quite a youngster, actually. I mean, I don't know how I even was allowed in to see the very first Star Wars movie. I was completely blown away by it, particularly by the opening image of that film. I'm looking at this as a 6 or 7 year old thinking, that's not real, but it looks real. And then I'm hearing all these sounds behind me, and I see this huge ship fly over my head. And I'm just looking at all this, trying to understand how this feels real, looks real, but I know it's not real. And that's, for me, the essence of filmmaking. You know, I would, of course, then read all the magazines like Starlog and everything else to figure out that, in fact, it was all trickery, that the ships weren't flying over the camera. The camera was actually flying over the models, and that created the movement. So all this, including the way in which it was lit, in a very realistic way, just inspired me to become a cinematographer.
I would love to say that you're the first person who's been on the show to tell us that you were inspired by Star Wars, but I would say that Star Wars has inspired an entire generation of filmmakers. There is something, I think, of certainly about having that theatrical experience with the crescendo of music and, like, you know, being then all of a sudden taken into the space that no one expected to go. So you're enthusiastically inspired as a youngster. Then you start to get involved in actual production. I'm going to say probably what, mid-90s, something like that. And I think that we're probably contemporaries. It was early 90s for me when I first started getting into any sort of professional work. I want to jump. Like, you did a lot of work in television and in movies, but TV, it really seems to have been the predominance of a lot of the work you did. Did a ton of stuff for TV series, TV movies, and you got a little show called Boardwalk Empire. How important was Boardwalk Empire in changing the trajectory of your career?
Well, I was very fortunate to be hired by Tim Van Patten, who's become a great friend of mine. But what was also wonderful was how generous they were about making sure that I felt like I was also contributing. So they wouldn't necessarily tell me exactly how to do things, but they would sort of give me visual references or sometimes give me some good advice about what to do with a certain set up and how you can be inspired every day by the challenge of trying to meet the expectations of great cinematographers.
You know, Jonathan, it's been really wonderful having you on the show. Are you on something new right now? Are you on Three Body Problems Season 2? Can you talk about what your next thing is? Or what are you doing?
Nothing immediately. So it's I look forward to the next opportunity.
All right. Well, Jonathan, hey, thank you so much for being on the show. It really was wonderful to talk to you, and I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right, so that was Jonathan Freeman. Hey, thank you so much for being on the show. Three Body Problem, what a huge hit. Congratulations again.
Check it out on Netflix if you haven't already. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. So, Ben, you'll never guess what time it is.
What time would that be?
It is time to pay the bills. We have to thank our fine friends over at Airy, makers of high-quality cameras, lenses, lighting. There was just a big trade show in Los Angeles called Cine Gear.
Never heard of it.
Airy had a bunch of announcements. Some of them, I think, kind of stole the show. They've got a new single channel follow focus hand unit, Hi5 SX. You know, it's interesting, though, too. Airy has really been very good about collaborating with other manufacturers. And I got to give them a huge credit for their PCA, which is their professional camera accessories. They build all kinds of really good stuff, sort of bringing the infrastructure and style of all of the cool Airy accessories to other cameras. And one of those other cameras is the Canon C400, which was just announced at the show. And already, Airy's got all the accessories that look like it fits exactly into sort of that Alexa ecosystem for the C400. And I think that's really cool. It's a excellent, world-class, high-standard set of accessories. Cage, shoulder pads, rod mounts, all the things that you would want in professional camera accessories. And they could have just said, hey, you know what? Our technology, our standards are just for us, and you go find something else. But no, they do it for the C400, which is a super, super cool new camera. So, hey, hats off to Airy. Congratulations on all the new product introductions from CineGear. But definitely, if you're interested in the C400, the C400 cage, check it out over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com.
And now, short ends.
So, Ben, it is our short end time once again. It's where we talk about our obsession of the week. What is your obsession? What are you all about right now?
Well, I guess I wanted to talk about Adobe, who's having a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad week. And anyone who's heard me talk about Adobe knows I'm a big Adobe fan. I use Adobe products pretty much daily. I do a whole lot of editing, and I've been using Premiere since Final Cut Pro X came out in 2011. And I will go to the grave. From hell's heart, I smite thee, Final Cut Pro X. I don't like it. But Adobe had kind of a 1-2 punch. Like if you Google Adobe and then click the news button, you'll find that it's in the news for two different things. One is the US is suing them. Like the Department of Justice is coming after Adobe. And it's because Adobe has basically created a wheel within a wheel, a Gordian knot that is hard to get out of. If you cancel your subscription, they still charge you. It's very, very hard. So basically the US is suing them. And that's not great. But the other half of Adobe is that there was an update to their terms of service. And their terms of service basically said that they could use user data, meaning, you know, the shit you're editing, whatever you're doing with Adobe software. So if something you're doing in Photoshop or something you're doing in Lightroom or something you're doing in Premiere or something you're doing in Audition, and they could basically use that. What it came down to was they were using it to train their AI. They were using it to train Firefly and Sensei and all of their many AIs. And they just changed their terms of service that said that they could do that with your data. And so I don't know how serious it is. If you were to go on YouTube and look at people who kind of cover this stuff, you would think people are dropping like flies off of the Adobe platform. Adobe has done something big corporations don't usually do, which is like they've updated their terms of service and been like, no, that's not what we meant. We're not doing it. And I actually, call me naive, I'm sure somebody would explain to me why I'm an idiot for saying this. I don't really think Adobe's doing anything that bad with your data, but their terms of service were freaking weird. And it caused a giant stir amongst people who use it for work. Because, you know, honestly, if you're using Photoshop for work, you know, photos from a wedding or something, those photos aren't really yours to go into a data set that Adobe Firefly is using to train its generative AI on. And the whole vibe on Adobe Firefly has always been that they only used images that Adobe had already licensed. So like they have their own stock library. So the whole thing about Firefly is they were using those images and also public domain images. And so it changes it a lot if suddenly they're using user images. And I would say, if you're going to do that, Adobe, you got to drop the price. Like if you're making money off of my work now, you better drop the freaking price. But that's my short end, Adobe in the hot seat.
Yeah, I got to agree with your assessment there, especially like if they're taking your data and using it to train their AI, there's already a really well-established precedent now that anyone who's doing that, like as a job, is being compensated. Anyone whose work that's going into that should be compensated. There's like, you know, so if they want to just take everyone's stuff and use it to train their AI, I feel like their business model needs to be adjusted, because frankly, it certainly doesn't make sense for them to charge the prices that they're charging and then to be exploiting the customer data the same way. I remember seeing that disclaimer pop up saying, we're going to use your data, but it was really unclear of what they wanted to use it for. So that's
yeah, really no, Adobe users are up in arms and people are hopping ship, and you know, it's probably a great week to be DaVinci Resolve, you know. I mean, the thing is that Adobe really does have a bit of a monopoly when you go like, okay, I love Premiere, but it's obviously not the only game in town. You can edit video competently on many platforms, but what really competes with After Effects or Photoshop? Very little. Like, there's almost nothing that can do what those two programs do as well as they can with as entrenched a user base. Yeah, I mean, there's stuff out there that'll do sort of what After Effects does, and there is stuff that'll do what Photoshop does, but those are such industry standard programs that it would be really hard for me to step away from Photoshop. And these days, ironically, with generative fill and some of the new stuff they've added in Photoshop, I don't really know who could compete with that.
Yeah, that's very true.
So what is your pet obsession this week, sir?
I got a couple of things, but one of them is just from yesterday.
Oh boy.
Yeah, it's called HitPaw. Have you heard of HitPaw? You seem like the type of guy who might know about HitPaw.
I've never heard of HitPaw.
No. All right, so we're not sponsored by HitPaw. We get no kickback from HitPaw, but HitPaw is a...
But HitPaw, you can call us and we'll take your money. We're happy to...
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know what country they're from, but I would say, based on the English, probably not a place where English is the native language. But anyway, it's a online service and also downloadable apps, including AI image enhancement apps, including like, hey, this shot is completely out of focus, but how do I salvage the shot sort of feature? And they've got some software, which seems, you know, pretty fair. You can own it for $350 forever, or you can license it for a year for around $150, or you can get it for, I think, a month for like $70 or something like that. But they have very specifically an online version of that exact same tool that has some limitations. The limitation is you can only go 10 minutes and it can only be 200 megabytes. But if you screw up a shot and that shot is supposed to be like on YouTube and you can compress down, you know, your data stream to, let's say, a 200 megabyte file that's less than 10 minutes long, you can get like a week license of this for like $6 or $7, and you can get a monthly license for $25. And I'm not going to say who it was, but someone I know recently recorded an interview entirely out of focus the entire time. And I would say unusable, because the background was totally in focus and they were completely out of focus. So when I saw that, I was like, I would ordinarily say you have to redo this, but let me just check to see if there's any AI tool now available that you could do this. And there's a few of them out there. HitPaw was just one of them. But because HitPaw had a pretty inexpensive way to try this out, and they do a little online preview for free, they'll render like 45 frames so you can kind of see what it'll look like. It doesn't look exactly right, but for relatively quick shots, now it just does not look unusable. It looks like, you know, maybe someone's face has some detail and there's sort of like some softer areas kind of around their face where there's less detail, but the face enhancement technology that they have more or less refocused an entirely out of focus shot and made it, I would say, pretty usable. Certainly usable enough for a compressed YouTube video that someone is probably mostly going to watch on their phone. So $23, you get, I think it's like 30 gigabytes maybe worth of files you can upload in a month. I only needed about 600 megabytes worth of stuff, but that's a pretty cheap fix. It's a pretty cheap fix after the fact. So AI technology of the rescue, hitpaw.com. You'll see they have a whole bunch of different things. The only one I did was the Enhance, and it's under the video section. It's called AI Video Enhancer. And I feel like this is really what AI is good for. AI is good for solving some problems that otherwise you might not be able to solve, and paying a reasonable fee for it. You know, it was a little bit annoying. It doesn't exactly fix it for you on the spot. You have to upload the file, and then like 6 or 8 hours later, they email you and say, oh, you can download your file now. We've finished the rendering. But that's not too bad, considering it'll save you. It'll save you a fortune. And if you really think you're going to screw up a lot and do a lot of things out of focus, maybe
just... I like to screw up everything, man.
When I'm on a job,
I want that client to have zero faith in me, and then be like, when they see the final thing, be like, hey, that's adequate. Wow, that surpassed my expectations with rank level adequacy.
Well, I was going to say, $350 is not the end of the world to own something that saves your bacon.
$350 is cheaper than doing a pickup shoot. That's for goddamn sure.
Absolutely. But if you have something that's like a web video and it's super compressed and it's probably going to be like, you know, forgettable or ephemeral or whatever it is, now you can have a pretty...
And it's academic. This kind of stuff is going to get better. I don't believe that generative AI is going to get so great. Like, I've been noticing on Twitter, the people who are talking about AI, generative AI specifically, are becoming so much like the people who were talking about crypto 4 years ago, that they're like, somebody was like, in 2 years, there will be no movie industry because AI is going to do everything. And I'm like,
who talked about VR, the same people who talked about 3D, all the other tech bros are moving fast.
You're completely wrong about that. Like, would I bet that AI won't be doing more heavy lifting in the future? AI is going to be doing more. Machine learning is going to be used for more and more stuff, because like this kind of a thing, because it's going to be good at like restoration. That's what it's freaking great at. Or I know I talk about it every freaking week, but stuff like what Michael Cioni is doing with Strata is exactly what we should be doing with AI. And I think, you know, generative AI like Sora as like a weird novelty, like for instance, at the Tribeca Film Festival, they have a sidebar for shorts that were made entirely in Sora that they're doing this week. And it's like, okay, that's interesting. I'm willing to bet money that none of them would have gotten into the Tribeca Film Festival had they not been made in Sora. If somebody had gone out and just made those as films traditionally, nobody would be clamoring for that. But good on them. I'm not against people trying to use it to tell stories. It's going to be fine. But this is exactly, I'm looking at the website right now, like this is exactly the kind of thing that AI just really excels at and will save your ass. And you know, it's the kind of thing too where it's like, don't buy it till you have a shot that's out of focus and you're screwed. It's $350 is cheaper than getting your camera crew back out there and getting yourself out there and buying everybody lunch and doing everything all over again.
You're exactly right. And I think that this is what people will do. And eventually it will get really good at that. And it'll probably cost less because more and more people are going to do it.
Well, what's going to keep happening is that these DaVinci Resolve or Adobe Premiere, Avid doesn't tend to do this kind of thing, but specifically DaVinci or Premiere will just buy this technology and put it into their software.
Actually, Adobe's already teased that they have something like this. They just haven't released it yet. But yeah, they've already teased that they've got something. There's something on GitHub about it. So anyway, Ben, I think that's just about going to do it for this week. Where can people find you? They want to track you down.
If you want to track me down, I'll give you the Apple tracker ID. I've been microchipped like your puppy. Go to benrock.com.
Turns out it's Starbucks in Sherman Oaks.
That's pretty much it. If you're at Starbucks in Sherman Oaks, throw a rock, you'll probably hit me in the face. Actually, they got rid of all the seating at my local Starbucks, so I'm not usually there. Anyway, no, go to benrock.com, check it out, watch my reel, read up on my stuff. Feel free to follow me on Twitter, where I try and be an amateur stand-up comedian sometimes, and also sometimes go on extended rants, which periodically even go a little viral. So what do you know?
Yeah, you are definitely a ranter.
I love a good Twitter rant, and one of them is that I refuse to call it X. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com, Hot Rod Cameras Burbank, Hot Rod Cameras Portland. So yeah, that's where you can typically find me. Also LinkedIn once in a while. Ben, who made this show possible? Who gets our thank yous?
Well, as always, our producer, first and foremost, our producer, Alana Cody, lining up the interviews. We got a couple of good ones coming up that we've done. We got a couple of great ones already in the can. And we did, I'm sure that some of our listeners noticed, we dropped two episodes this week. So we're not doing two episodes every week, but this week we're doing two episodes to kind of catch up for last week when we did zero episodes. Yeah, because we had a COVID situation. Wasn't me this time for a change. We should thank Ben Katz, our amazing editor, who had to edit twice as many episodes this week. Thank you, Ben. We love you. We think you're the best. And last but not least, we should thank Kays Alatrakshi, who composed and recorded every scrap of music that you heard on this podcast. Check him out at musicbykays.com. Hire him to score your next project. Yada, yada, yada. You know exactly what he does. He does everything. He doesn't just score. He directs. He does visual effects. He does color grading. But he's good. He's great at all those things. But I have good intel that his favorite thing to do is to score. So hire him to do that.
Nice. All right, Ben. I'd say that we've just about wrapped it up for this show. Do you want to take us out?
That's a wrap.
Oh, could you say it cheesier?
That's a wrap.
Perfect. Thank you.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.